Hello and welcome to the Waterways Ireland podcast series with me, Turtle Bunbury. In this series, we are exploring the rich history of Ireland's waterways from the beginning of recorded time to the present day. One of the most iconic images of the Canal Age was the sight of boats laden with Guinness barrels heading out of Dublin along the Grand Canal and the Royal Canal, and then making their stately procession through the Irish countryside. It is a fabulous part of the waterways heritage, and I'm so pleased to talk through it all with the Dublin historian Cathy Scuffle. Cathy Scuffle, historian in residence in Dublin South Central, grew up between not one but two lines of canal, so she has had waterways in her blood since she could walk. She spoke with me about the Guinness boats on the Grand Canal, not to mention the Rialto Devil, and how on earth was James Bond connected to it all? Hello, Cathy.
Hello, Turtle. Delighted to be here.
Thanks, Cathy. Listen, first up, do you live near one of the canals?
Yes, I grew up sandwiched between the main line and the circular line. So I grew up in Dolphin's Barn. So both pieces of the canal were part of my growing up.
Wow. Okay. Of the Grand Canal and the Royal Canal?
No, the Grand Canal where it split. So you had the main line.
Oh, sorry. Yes.
And you also had the circular line. So Dolphin's Barn was sandwiched between the two.
Okay.
We had a canal playground on either side of where I lived.
Oh, brilliant. Okay. Right.
With regard to local children and the barges, they would often shout at the bargeman as he's going by, bring us back a parrot, you know, in other words, that they were going to exotic places. And these would be the barges heading down the Grand Canal, because the children in Dublin thought anywhere outside, you know, Clondalkin was very exotic indeed.
Yes, fair
so
enough,
so this would be, you know, bring us back a parrot was a real
bring us back a parrot.
Bring us back a parrot was one. The other thing was getting a sketch or getting a snaff. If you would jump on the barge, be allowed to jump on it at Rialto Bridge and get the little jaunt up to the harbour and get off up there.
But it must have been heaving. Was not everybody trying to jump on it?
Well, there was quite a queue. So it was it was a thing that was done, presumably because some of the bargemen were local and they knew the children and they would let them hitch a ride, if you like, on the barge going up so far towards the harbour and then let them off again. I don't think health and safety would let us do that today, but it certainly was something that was done at the time. And there was another little point at the canal. The children called it the gut. And it was a narrowing of the Grand Canal just before you went into the harbour at James Street. And it was only the width of a canal boat. And the whole idea was to filter the traffic in and out, control the traffic moving in and out of the harbour. And it is at that point later on that a metal bridge is built over to bring the children to school in Basin Street, because the parish schools were in Basin Street, James Street School for the boys and Basin Lane for the girls. But the children were jumping the gut to get over, get into school. So they eventually built a bridge over it to take the children in.
Right. So they didn't arrive soaked to the skin.
Exactly. And the final thing, just about the bargemen, the first bridge that you go under leaving James's Harbour was Rialto Bridge, the bridge at Rialto. So the Lewis goes under it today. But set into the bed, the roof of that bridge, was a little headed figure. And the bargemen would touch it for luck on their way out, because that's the first bridge they went under before they continued their 80-odd mile journey west. And that was known as the Rialto Devil.
The Rialto Devil, my goodness.
The little head.
And who was it? Do we know who it was? Or who put it there or anything?
No, the Rialto Devil, it's just a head, a carved head that was embedded into the base of the bridge. And if you could today go under the bridge, as I had done as a child, you would have noticed the displaced bricks under the bridge where the head had been. It's quite obvious there's a repair done to the arch of the bridge. and something is missing. Something has been removed. So it was a bit of a mystery as to where the head had gone after the canal was decommissioned, but it turned up.
Oh.
The head, the Rialto Devil, as was known, had been taken from the bridge at some stage as the canal was being decommissioned and brought up to the Grand Canal Harbour at the top of Eklund Street, at James Street there, and placed into the side wall of one of the buildings. And it has been revealed as they're redeveloping that site. And the locals are watching closely to see if the Rialto Devil head is brought back to the site, as it should be, because it's in safekeeping, we understand, at the moment, as the redeveloping is taking place.
Well, my goodness. Better the devil you know and all that.
And the Rialto Devil's the best of all.
The Rialto Devil. Brilliant. Okay, love it. Love it. Look, it's the history. I mean, the Grand Canal, it's conceived in the 1750s. That is the same decade that the Guinness Brewery is established. By 1785, it connects with the River Barrow at Monastrevin. By 1803, it reaches the Shannon. And Guinness, it had a key role through that harbour at St. James's Gate. Can you tell us a little bit about that harbour? And did Guinness help sponsor the construction of the canal so that it could transport its stout? Or have I got that wrong? Or would it have been involved at that stage?
They worked side by side. But just to bring you back a little bit, with the Grand Canal itself, the whole idea was being bounced around from about 1715. We don't really move that fast on big infrastructure projects in Ireland. So it was a long time in the making. And when they started digging the canal, they didn't start at the harbour. They started much further out. So beyond Clondalkin, they started digging the canal from there. And at the time, the main push for the canal was really an increased water supply for Dublin. Although it was going to be a transport system, it wasn't really seen as something for Guinness initially.
Sure.
It was seen as a source of water for Dublin Corporation.
A water supply, yeah. Right. Okay, for the good citizens of the capital.
Mm, yeah. So we end up with a supply of two things connected with the canal, really, water and Guinness eventually. But they grow side by side. The harbour at James's Street was actually built by Sir James Bond. I love this. We had a James Bond involved in developing the harbour.
Brilliant. Bond, James Bond.
So we have a Bond Street right beside the site.
Yeah.
And he developed it primarily for a market. And that's where we get Market Street from.
Okay.
So he was looking at it in terms of bringing fresh produce up from the countryside to the city and a market then developing around it. The market eventually was abandoned around 1817. So it ran from about 1786 to 1817. So Sir James Bond, we have to get James Bond in there somewhere.
Excellent. Yeah, absolutely. We have to give him a mention. Okay. And then he is in the land of St. James himself as well.
He was the director of the Grand Canal Company. So he obviously saw the canal as an opportunity to develop a market in the area. It's nice that we've two place names in the Guinness complex that are connected to him.
Yeah.
Bond Street and Market Street. They're connected to that.
Okay, so then with the harbour, James's Harbour, when do you know, we know when that was built?
Yeah, I think it's somewhere before 1786. Bond himself takes part of the harbour and extends it as his market spot. But they were building it before they built the circular line. The actual harbour in James's Street was established and it was used for both passenger and freight. And of course, the circular line had to be built then to take the passenger traffic because it was too much to run it all from James's Street.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Okay. And then, okay. So now you've got the harbour beside the brewery and yes, it's supplying the city with water supply, but it's also supplying Guinness with water for the brewery.
Yes.
And it's also offering, enabling Guinness to transport its stout around Ireland to the Midlands. Okay, let's go and look at how they're doing that. What sort of barges are going off in the 18th century? How is Guinness getting out into the countryside?
Guinness was the biggest customer customer of the Grand Canal Company, because, as you mentioned, it quite rightly provided them with a major transport system to move their raw materials from the agricultural part of Ireland up and then to send the finished product out. And it was absolutely essential to the development of the brewery that they had the canal system right on their doorstep. They used it very, very much so for bringing up the barley and bringing up the hops. And that meant they arrived on site and they could then do the process and get the finished product down. So you end up with a number of warehouses at various locations along the Grand Canal that are connected solely with Guinness. And then you have a number of canal side pubs developing. And whilst they might be a place to change the horses or whatever for the bargemen, they were certainly agents for Guinness as well. So you could offload quite a number of barrels and then transport them further.
Okay, that's interesting. Right. I mean, it is like a bit of a magic trick. It must have seemed like that in the 18th century when you send off this barley and malt up to Dublin and it comes, ba-da, and it comes back in these barrels of delicious stout. Okay, so the barges themselves, I'm presuming that they were horse-drawn in those early days. When would Guinness have made the switch? Not until the 20th century? Or
the key thing to remember is the barges, or the boats as they're called. The barges were more likely to refer to the ones that Guinness used on the Liffey.
On the Liffey, yeah.
The ones on the canal were known as boats or canal boats. They were in the main owned by the Grand Canal Company. So Guinness is just a customer of the Grand Canal Company for the use of the barges. They're not, strictly speaking, owned by Guinness. How the legend comes about is the colour of the barges was a cream and black colour system, which resembled
like a frothy pint.
resembled the pint. And and obviously the majority of items being carried related to the brewery. So the whole thing becomes part of the one, if you like. But they were Grand Canal barges.
That's interesting. Okay, so it wasn't the Guinness owned a fleet of boats. It was actually they rented them. I mean, they were the biggest customer of the Grand Canal Company. Right?
They hired them.
Yeah, they hired them. Okay, how interesting. All right. And do we know how many barges there were or how often they went?
I tried hard when I knew this question might come up, and I had a good look around to see if I could get a definitive figure. And obviously, as business changed, you had more barges or less barges depending on the economic situation. They were primarily horse-drawn in the early years. They did experiment with a couple of steam-powered barges, but discovered they weren't any better than the poor old horse pulling the barge.
Right.
And even up to, say, 1901, you still find a huge number of people living in the canal property around the harbour who are engaged in business relating to the horse. So you have the groomsman, the harness maker, the stable hand, they're all living there. But if you look at the same census for 1911, same area, most of them are gone, and that ties in perfectly with the motorization of the barges.
How interesting. Okay, so it happens like basically in the Edwardian age between 1900 and just the First World War.
It does, very much so.
Okay, so and all those professions they're just not to be found anymore. Is that what you're saying? They've changed. They've updated themselves. Okay.
They did.
I interviewed for the Vanishing Ireland project. I interviewed a boatman called Tom Connolly, who went up and down the Grand Canal, and he was saying that he would load up with anything up to 450 kegs at James Street, and then he'd go off to Shannon Harbour. That was actually his childhood home, as it happens. And then, as you say, they'd collect a cargo of malt barley to bring it back to the Guinness Brewery, or maybe they'd pick up some sugar beet if they were down on the Barrow. But that figure always stuck in my head, 450 kegs. Would that have been, is that a sort of standard cargo, or have you come across those sort of figures?
I've heard between 400 and 450. So it would vary, but certainly it was always more than 400 that were carried on the barges or on the boats.
Okay. Heading out. Okay. And then you mentioned earlier that, that they would go to some of the pubs that, obviously the canals are clearly the transportation method, but in terms of distribution. So, let's go to the Royal Canal for a moment, but because I know that barrels of Guinness were dropped off at a place called Thomas O'Keefe's at Kilcock in County Kildare. And I think O'Keefe's is the oldest canal side pub in Ireland, 1796. Maybe there's other contenders. But O'Keefe's would then distribute the stout to all the other pubs in the district. And was that standard? Were there specific distributors like O'Keefe's who then brought the Guinness onwards to rural pubs?
If you look at the Grand Canal network, when you go out as far as Clondalk and you start to find pubs beside the canal, we had one called the Lock and Key, for example. So it was fairly obvious that that would be one where you offload it and you could, it was a distribution centre for County Dublin. There was another one at near Ballyfermot. Again, it would have been rural, Ballyfermot, just this pub looming up in the countryside, right beside the canal themselves, particularly developing beside the canal to act as distribution points and also stop-off points for the bargemen to have a rest or to change horses or to address some issue if there had been anything that had arisen along the way. So it becomes a feature of the Irish countryside that these pubs develop close to the canal, and they also are distribution points onward. Some of them would have had even bottling arrangements within their own pub and labelling. You find some of the labels in the Guinness archive that were used by some of the pubs for they bottled the Guinness, labelled it and distributed it locally. It was a brilliant system, a fantastic just-in-time system for its era. It wouldn't work as well today, but it was just absolutely amazing at the time to do that.
It is incredible. It's like sort of a garage network of Maxall garages that provides everything for the Guinness. Let's home in on one of the more amusing aspects of it, and we're going to talk about the gimlet or the gimlet. I don't know which way you pronounce it. The gimlet, I think. They have a gimlet, and Cathy, I'll explain this in a moment. They have a gimlet proudly on display in the museum in my hometown of Carlow. It's actually on loan from John O'Neill, who's the lock keeper at Fenice Court, who was a guest on an earlier episode of this series. Now, when you look at the description of this curious looking gadget, Carlow Museum call it a much sought after extra tool to have on board. The device was used to siphon porter from the barrels. It is a pretty hilarious gadget. I don't know, Cathy, have you seen one? Maybe you didn't know it was called a gimlet or a gimlet.
I didn't know it was called a gimlet, but I was aware that there was the boatman's tincture included in the barrel. And if you like, it's a nice little bonus. They always put extra in the barrel, knowing the intact barrel wouldn't arrive at its destination. So it was for the boatmen.
As in it would have been tapped along the way.
Yeah. Exactly. And by the time they got to the end, they had their bonus, and their bonus was a pint of Guinness.
Right. OK. Well, I mean, I saw an unwritten law stating that a sweet can was the maximum you could take from a firkin, while the limit for a hogshead was a biscuit tin. I don't know if this is true, but anyway, you're encouraged to take no more than that or you'd be in trouble. But that's interesting. So Guinness kind of had given up and made an allowance for it, adding a few extra pints to each keg. Is that what goes down as evaporation or leakage?
Spillage.
Village. Well, look, in fairness now, you can imagine the lads out on a long journey, and it's very slow. Those barges were traveling at a very slow sort of 2 miles an hour or something, 2 kilometers an hour. So on a good summer's evening, you can imagine the thirsty boatman, you know, going in tapping in and enjoying a little drop of porter along the way. I've also heard the legend that the voyage itself, that long journey, provided the perfect time and conditions for the perfect pint on those long, stately journeys. Have you heard that before?
I have heard that one. The fermenting process continued in the barrel as the long journey, and also the rocking of the boat would help make sure that everything was mixed up very nicely by the time it arrived at its destination. We like the slow pull, the slow pour of the Guinness. So I think it all feeds into the one legend. And yes, I'm never going to question that one. I won't question that one at all.
It does. It feels like a future Guinness ad in the making. I feel that the canal journeys. Kath, we've talked a lot about the Grand Canal, but obviously the Guinness was using the Royal Canal as well. How was it getting its Guinness from St. James's Gate to the Royal Canal?
Some of it was using the little internal train system to bring it down to the quays near Euston Station. And then it would be brought by, initially it would have been horse and cart, you know, the drays, the Guinness drays, sure, brought over to the harbour at Royal Canal Bank near Phibsborough. But the harbour at Royal Canal Bank was built with Jemison in mind, because the Jemison distillery was a little bit closer, would have been pretty much on the site there. So the Jemison distillery used the Royal Canal a little bit more than Guinness did.
Guinness, yeah.
But certainly Guinness used it for bringing items to Longford and that direction.
Kilcock, yeah, and so forth. Yeah,
exactly, exactly.
Okay, so we've mentioned that Guinness was the Grand Canal Company's biggest customer. Then, well, let's go to roughly the emergency, World War II. At the end of that, the fuel supplies return, and Guinness, unlike everybody else, they move into trucks. And I think that is when we see the decline and end of the Guinness boats. Is that the right era?
That is absolutely true. In fact, in a way, the emergency, the World War II, was a lifeline for the canal for just that little bit longer, because it brought the turf up from the Midlands up to the city of Dublin. And in some ways that allowed it to continue for a little bit longer than probably it would have if World War II hadn't happened. The last Guinness barge, or the last barge carrying Guinness, left in 1960. So it left James's Harbour in 1960. And it's only now that site has been redeveloped.
Wow.
So it has taken from 1960 to 2023 to redevelop that particular site. So it's been a slow decline, a little bit like the slow pour of the Guinness.
Sure.
Everything is a bit slow when we're doing things.
Everything takes its time. And roughly the same, I know we touched on it a bit, but the Guinness barges, as you say, on the Liffey, they were wrapping up around about the early 60s as well, right?
Well, they were very much so, very much so. What Guinness did, though, it took warehousing down in Ringsend. So it was considering its port focus as well as its canal focus. And then it had its warehousing in Ballinasloe and also Tullamore. So there were routes along the canal that they actually had buildings that were used for collecting their raw material and for passing on their finished products. So they set up their own network in line with the canal. So it's more the buildings rather than the boats that they had. And they leased the boats or hired the boats from the Grand Canal Company.
So there's that legacy of those buildings still exists all along the two canals?
Some of the warehouses are still there or have only recently been decommissioned or demolished. But certainly you had warehousing, particularly at the bigger harbours, like Tullamore would have had lovely stone-cut buildings around it, similar to what you saw on the Grand Canal at James Street. And of course, all the streets along the Grand Canal there were in some way connected with malting, brewing, storage of grain, that type of thing. So all the little streets around James Street were all part of this bigger network supplying the brewery itself.
It is amazing. I mean, I hadn't realised obviously I knew Guinness and the canals were interlinked, but I hadn't realised the extent to which Guinness was, you know, there from the outset, as we've discussed earlier. But that whole notion that before the Grand Canal docks were built at Ringsend, I mean, then St. James's Harbour for a while would have been the central hub of the Grand Canal system, right?
Absolutely. And it remained very, very much part of the internal network of distribution for Ireland, where the ports would have been for the export abroad. The system for moving Guinness around within Ireland was the Grand Canal. And it really worked very, very well for Guinness. And it was a very, very long relationship between the two. And as you say, it was really road transport that eventually changed the whole thing, and the canal system. The last freight left in 1960. So that was the end of it.
My goodness. And it would still be quite a sight for Irish ink abroad if we still had boats heading down the canals laden with kegs of Guinness and fellas tapping into them occasionally.
Certainly would.
Listen, Kathy, that's brilliant. I've thoroughly enjoyed the chat. Thank you so much for your wonderful insights into the remarkable golden age of Guinness on the canals.
Thank you very much, Turtle. A pleasure.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of Waterways Through Time. You'll find more episodes on waterwaysireland.org or on Alexa, Spotify, Google, or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll find my archive of historical stories, mostly Irish, at turtlebunbury.com. My sincere thanks to series producer Ali Bunbury and technical producer Mary Burke.